Smart Talk is supported by Capital Blue Cross, providing healthcare coverage accepted by doctors and specialists in all 50 states. More information is available at capitalbluecross.com. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC, dedicated to pursuing and pioneering treatments that will one day be the standard worldwide. For more information, visit upmc.com/happening today.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. I'm Scott Lamar. The invasive spotted lanternfly seems to be everywhere, or at least on buildings and structures. Since showing up in Berks County in 2014, the lanternfly has become a pest in Pennsylvania that can pose a danger to trees and plants, but not to humans. With few natural enemies in Pennsylvania and even difficult to eliminate with pesticides, we are told to squish the bugs on sight. Now, that doesn't seem to be the most efficient or backed by science way to control the lanternfly, but that's where we are. On today's Smart Talk, we address what many of you are talking about right now, the spotted lanternfly. Joining us is Kelly Hoover, professor of entomology at the Center for Chemical Ecology and the Center for Pollinator Research and Insect Biodiversity at Penn State. Dr. Hoover, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
I have to say, in my almost 12 years of hosting this show, I have never had so many of my coworkers clamoring for us to address a topic like this one. And that's because here at the WITF Public Media Center, we run a gauntlet every day of spotted lanternflies. They're everywhere. Are there more of them this year, or are we just noticing them more?
There are more of them this year in places they were not found before. So they have been spreading to more locations. And in the locations where they arrived, like near Harrisburg, populations have grown since they first arrived there several years ago. So they wane and fall and then rise back up again. Over time. And some of that has to do with availability of food. And when they run out of food, they leave the area and go somewhere else.
Is that what they're driven by? I mean, you say that they, you know, one place, then go somewhere else. It's all driven by where the food is available?
Well, it's driven by two things, because all plants and animals basically have two things that they need to do. They need to feed to grow. And then they also need to find each other to mate. So that's why a lot of plants have pollinators to do the job for them. So they are starting to mate now. This is about the time of year you'll find a lot more of them on one tree, finding a mate and mating. And they've just about started to lay eggs just at the very beginning. So they're adults for a long time, 4 months approximately. So we're going to notice them when they're around in large numbers.
How do you count them? And I assume you don't have a census for...
That's a very good question.
No, but how do you know there are more of them?
Well, you can get a sense of it just by seeing how covered trees are in an area or how they're sparse. And the way that we typically do counts is we use traps, and we every week or every 2 weeks, whatever it is, we'll count the number that are on trees that have landed in or on traps. There's different kinds of traps. That's one way. The other is visual search. And frankly, as adults, just counting them on a tree with your eyeballs and giving yourself X amount of time, like I'm going to count for 5 minutes, everyone I can see. That's a pretty good indicator of how many there are.
You actually do that? You stand for five minutes and count?
Yeah, there are those of us who actually do that. And certainly the agencies that are trying to manage them, USDA and Pennsylvania Department of Ag, they do that as well as counting the number of egg masses in the spring or in the fall when all the leaves come off the trees so they can see them better to get an idea of where populations might be in the coming year.
I'm going to jump around on you with some of these questions, but
go right ahead.
You have been studying the spotted lanternfly at Penn State for the last few years now. What have we learned? I mean, this invasive insect only came to Pennsylvania 8 years ago, but they're everywhere now. What have we learned?
Well, probably the most important things we've learned is, first of all, that they're incredibly good hitchhikers. So they can lay eggs or hop on a truck, a car, a railroad line, railroad cars, and in the baggage area of an airplane. On occasion, one even makes it into the passenger seating area on a plane. So they're really good at hitchhiking. And it's one of the reasons why we've all been cautioned, those of us who live in spotted lanternfly land, which is now about two-thirds of our state, we're being cautioned to be sure to check for insects on or in your car when you leave a quarantine county and to move into a county that's not under quarantine, to make sure you're not transporting them somewhere else. And that's how they're spreading these. That's how those big jumps happen, is by human-moderated or mediated transport.
All right, I just have to take a step back now, and I think worst case scenario is the pilot of a plane being surprised by a lanternfly landing on his or her neck. That doesn't seem like it would end well, but just put that out there. So you said two-thirds of the state. Where's the third that doesn't have them now?
Mostly in the Northwest and in North Central. So up in the Alleghenies, you know, where the Allegheny National Forest is, we don't think they're even going to make it there. But in there, we're concerned about them showing up in Erie, probably more than any place in the state, because of their incredible damage that they can do to grapes.
Yeah,
so of all our crops, grapes are by far more affected than anything else.
Yeah, and we plan to do a show here, or at least a segment of our show here in the near future, about how Pennsylvania's grape crop wineries have been impacted. But it's not just grapevines, grapes that they feed on. I mean, there are a lot of plants that they do feed on, correct?
That's right. And when they're very young, when they first hatch, in the early part of their life, they feed on a lot of different plants and a lot of different vines. They even like things like Virginia creeper and multiflora rose, and, you know, which are plants that we don't particularly care about, especially multiflora rose. But as they get older, they narrow down what they'll feed on, and they start to begin strongly preferring Tree of Heaven. And then as Tree of Heaven begins senescing, which should happen in the next week or so, they're going to start moving on to maples, because those are their next best food source after Tree of Heaven.
And ironically, Tree of Heaven is an invasive,
right,
plant here in Pennsylvania as well.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it grows very well in all disturbed areas, which by definition, along the sides of the railroad tracks, is a disturbed area. So there are lots of Tree of Heaven lining our railroad tracks, which is how they ended up out where you are and also out in Pittsburgh. They hopped the train.
You said that you didn't think that they would make their way to the Northwest other than maybe Erie, where we're concerned about that. But why don't you think we'll make it that far?
Well, I think it's more likely to not succeed in North Central. Elk County, up in Tioga County. And I think it's just due to there not being enough warm enough days for them to go through complete development to laying eggs. I could be wrong. I mean, global warming's changing so many things that, and they seem to be able to adapt a bit to cooler climates as well as to warmer climates. So they're quite adaptable.
Where in Asia did they come from?
We don't know exactly. There has been genetic work done to try to identify where they came from, what part of China. At first, we thought they came from South Korea, where it was introduced there in 2013, but it turned out not to be the case. So it's probably from China somewhere.
Reason I asked that question, I was wondering if we knew what the climate was like what the weather was like, whether it was similar to what we have here in Pennsylvania.
Well, there have certainly been comparisons done at taking the latitudes of where it shows up in China, where it can survive in China and South Korea and Japan, and putting that on the United States and what those latitudes are. And it can survive in a large part of our country. Mm. You know, it may not make it in Nebraska or up in Canada, but we've been surprised by this insect before in terms of its ability to adapt.
Now, the spotted lanternfly has some natural enemies in China or, you know, where it came from in Asia. It doesn't Yes. here in Pennsylvania, does it?
We don't have them in Pennsylvania, but we do have some natural enemies that are generalists, meaning they eat lots of different things. We have some of those here in Pennsylvania that are feeding on lanternflies pretty well.
Oh, really?
Birds is one. Lots of birds will feed on them. And lots of different arthropods, spiders, yellow jackets, other predatory wasps, assassin bugs, ambush bugs. So there are quite a few. And praying mantises. In fact, in my common garden, where I have about 800 trees and lanternflies all over that area this year, there's more there this year than we've ever seen. And we're seeing large praying mantises sitting on the outsides of the screening we have around trees where we've confined lanternfly inside to test how they're affecting the tree. And the praying mantises are trying to get into enclosures. So I don't think they're going to make it because it's zip-tied closed. But we found this past spring lots of egg cases of praying mantises that had been laid on the trees where there were lanternfly the following, you know, the previous season. Mm. So they go after them.
I know there had been some talk about a wasp that was in Asia being introduced mm-hmm. here in the United States. Where do we stand with that? And is there a danger that we're introducing another native insect?
There is always a risk with using non-native natural enemies, bringing them in from another country where the pest is from. But at this point in time, there is a parasitic wasp. It's actually called a parasitoid, and it lays its eggs in the eggs of spotted lanternfly. That's how small it is. And they eat the eggs and develop into adult and pop out of the egg case. They have a bunch of different types that are from different parts of China, and some of them have too broad of a host range. They'll feed on caterpillars of endangered butterflies, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But they have a different strain that they're testing now, and we'll see how that goes. And then there's another one that is a parasitoid that goes after the nymphs. And that one is called a dryanid. And the difficulty there is rearing it. But they now have that down. So now they should be able to get enough of them to test them on non-target insects. So it's still quite a ways away. It takes years and years and years of testing and dealing with the bureaucracy of the USDA. to get approval. But there's good reason. There have been mistakes that have been made. So,
like what? Give us an example.
They proceed with caution.
Give us an example of a mistake that's been made that maybe people would recognize.
Well, the best example I can think of is these types of frogs that are supposed to feed on sugarcane borers. And they were introduced into Australia from Hawaii. And they never ate a single sugarcane grub, but they consumed all kinds of other animals. And they'll even eat small crocodiles. So, whoa. And they mate like crazy, and they've completely overwhelmed the country and outcompeted a lot of their native frogs. So, and they have poison in these glands on their shoulders.
Wow.
So if a dog bites down on it, it could kill it.
Yeah, that was a mistake.
Mistakes are made sometimes.
Yeah, that was a pretty big mistake.
That was a really big mistake. Yeah. That was a long time ago, but yeah. It was pretty disastrous.
Our guest is Dr. Kelly Hoover, professor of entomology at Penn State University. You know, I told you, Dr. Hoover, I'm jumping around on you, and I started the show by talking about the huge number of spotted lanternfly on our building here. It seems as though they are going to, you can go through a drive-through in a fast food restaurant, a taller building. I've heard of stadiums. I don't know about Beaver Stadium at Penn State, but that they're all over the place. I always assumed that was because the warmer temperatures that the cement, the brick holds. Does that have anything to do with it? Or, again, back to food?
I don't think so. Spotted lanternflies are attracted to tall silhouettes. So they think it's a tree. They don't have the best vision in the world. So they do have a tendency to fly into buildings. And it might just be that the building's in the way of where they're headed. Because they're not great flyers, they take off from a height. They always climb up as high as they can to take off to get as much lift as they can. Again, because they're not strong flyers. And then when they take off, they're somewhat gliding, and sometimes they don't get enough lift to get to the trees on the other side of the building, so they hit the building. And that can happen over and over. And when they hit the building, they tend to drop to the ground, so they pile up on the ground in front of the entrance to the building, let's say. So, and they'll either die there, or they'll manage to get up again and launch themselves off by climbing up to the top.
So they're lousy flyers. They can't see well. But when I go to squish one, they're very quick to make a move. And I, again, started the program by saying that we're told by the Department of Agriculture, kill as many as you can, squish as many as you can. I don't remember getting directives from the government, the state government, that this is how the best way, the most effective, okay, maybe not the most effective way, but a good way to get rid of an insect is to kill it by stepping on it. I mean, is it just that these things are that unique or what?
Well, I would say they're fairly unique in that they're actually quite sensitive to the insecticides that are being used to manage them. The problem is getting it to the insect. So if you inject a tree with an insecticide, it'll last for a few months, but then it begins waning its ability to kill them. And if you use something that kills them on contact, that lasts even less amount of time. So, and given how often they move and how far they can move, it's very hard to predict which trees do I treat. So you're constantly chasing them. It's really different from any insect I've ever worked on, where you have a crop like corn or soybean, and the pest is in the crop, it's not going anywhere, and you can treat the crop and you're fine. This insect will keep moving on you. So that's part of the problem. Now, will smashing them make a difference in their populations? No. But I guess it makes people feel better if they're on their property and they see them.
It makes them have a little bit of a sense of power over the spotted lanternfly.
Yeah, I'll show you. Yeah, I know what you mean.
That's right. So we have about 3 minutes left. I know that everyone is wondering, what can I do? What can I do to control the spotted lanternfly?
Well, the most important thing we can all do is make sure that we're not moving any of the life stages anywhere else. So that is our biggest worry, and that's our greatest risk. So it's important for people even if you're like coming to State College for the Penn State home game, you know, make sure that you check the inside of your, like people leave their tailgate up as they're loading their vehicle. And you have to check in and around everything in your vehicle to make sure they're not there. Look under the car in the wheel wells and under the windshield wipers, front and back, if you have a back one, because these are the places they tend to hide. And you want to make sure you get all of those out of your car. And this time of year, because they're beginning to lay eggs, you want to look for that white slap, I don't know what to call it, except like glob of eggs that it might have been laid underneath the car. So we have always had to check those things when we would come out of, well, let's say, Berks County and come back to State College when we were not in quarantine. Now I can go to all my field sites and I never leave a quarantine area because we have, I think we have 44 or 45 quarantine counties now.
Okay, so in the minute we have left, what does quarantine mean so that the people quarantine living in?
Quarantine basically means you are not to transport any life stages of that pest when you move something. And you, it also means if you're taking lounge chairs or lawn chairs, I guess I should say, or an ice chest with you, check it to make sure there's no egg masses laid on it. They will lay egg masses on deck furniture, on, you know, lawn mowers, just about anything.
Yeah, I've seen so many parks, municipal parks, where you see the wire around the tree because of, you know, birds, that the, is a danger to other wildlife as well. And in 30 seconds we have left, right?
Mm-hmm. So are you talking about wire on over a trap or over egg masses?
Over egg masses, yeah. And,
okay.
And we are out of time, so I didn't give you enough time to answer that. But I want to thank Dr. Kelly Hoover, who is a professor of entomology at Penn State. Thank you very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome, Scott. Have a good weekend.
You too. Coming up on Monday, Muhlenberg College has their latest poll out on a number of issues and candidates. We'll be talking about that on Monday's Smart Talk, so be sure to tune in. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great weekend.